Well, I'll try again. Any questions?
What would be the potential for like an entrance lateral conductor said to be an electric field?
Say again?
Like, so there's one of the horn crops where there's a, like a hollowed-out sphere in the middle of a infinite conductor, and then there's said to be an electric field. So what would be the potential of infinity in that?
Well, so in the absence of a battery, the electric field is going to be zero. But if we have a battery connected to the wire, then there will be an electric field that's needed in order to push those electrons along. So there is an electric field inside a wire that would be the voltage difference divided by the length of the wire. In this particular case, we're going to, it really is a Laplace solution sort of problem. So we're going to do kind of the usual thing. We're going to have a voltage that is minus E naught. I don't know if it's, is it cylindrical or spherical? Z or X, depending upon.
I think
it's a sphere. So then minus E naught times Z. And then it's a matter of setting up the equations with the boundary condition being that there can't be any current that's flowing into the vacuum sphere, right? Can't have any current flow there. Other questions? Well, aside from Laplace, the other thing that's been a reoccurring theme is the R minus R prime stuff, where we find fields by adding up sources. And that's what we did last time. We were adding up sources of magnetic field, which is current, in order to get what the magnetic field was under various special geometry. And this law here, called the law of Biot-Savart, is the main game. And it's made complicated by this cross product in contrast to the electric field. But we can still, in lots of kind of straightforward cases, integrate this up in order to get the magnetic field. So the easiest case is a long straight wire. It is cylindrically symmetric, so it doesn't matter where we choose to have our axis in the xy plane. And we might as well choose z equals zero because every altitude is the same on an infinite wire. So we chose to do this on the x-axis, and in the end we got a magnetic field that was only in the y direction, and that indicated that the magnetic field is really just going around. But r prime wants to point at the source, which is on the z-axis. The current is in the direction of the z-axis, so we just plugged those things in and we were off to the races, and we got this result, which is very useful for figuring out the direction of the magnetic field. So notice the R here is the cylindrical R, it's not the spherical R, it's our distance from the wire. And also notice the right-hand rule, that if you point your thumb in the direction of the current, your fingers are going to point in the direction that the magnetic field is twisting around that wire, right? Which is what we call the phi direction. So then we did the cylindrical shell. So it's the same thing as a wire, except there's vacuum on the inside. There's a current that's flowing on the surface. These k's are currents per length, just as j's are currents per area. So we have a total current I that's flowing through the circumference of the cylindrical shell. It's flowing in the z direction, and we're supposed to multiply k by dA, which is r d theta dz. And r prime was any point on the surface of the cylindrical shell, so we had a circle and then some altitude in order for that to occur. And what we showed is, I think this is kind of no surprise, that if we're outside of a cylindrical wire, the same formula applies, 1 over the distance from the center of the cylinder. And if we're inside the cylinder, there's no magnetic field. Very reminiscent of how it is with charged spheres. If we have a charged shell, if we have a surface charge density uniform on a sphere, there's no electric field on the inside, and the electric field on the outside is just like a point charge. So this is what we did: the wire, we did the cylinder with the current going up. So now we did the infinite cylinder with the current going around. So we call these things solenoids. So we needed a vector that was pointing around the so-called theta hat direction, and there it is. So k is in that direction. We have a little bit of area. And what we found is, I think, pretty surprising. That is to say that the magnetic field is zero on the outside of this this cylinder. And I don't know, for the case of the electric field inside the spherical shell, I can kind of see how that works, right? There's more charge per angle on the other side, even though it's further away, so it's going to attract me as much as the side that I'm closest to. But this is a little bit, at least to me, surprising, because if you look at one little piece of this sheet, for one of the homework problems, you know that what that produces is a magnetic field that's equal and opposite on either side of the sheet. So whatever this little piece is doing on the outside, it's doing exactly the same thing on the inside. And it's kind of hard to cancel out something that is co-equal like that. It must mean that everything else is producing an electric field that's, a magnetic field that's twice as big and is going in the same direction, so that it cancels it on the inside, it cancels it on the outside and doubles it on the inside. But I don't know, that charge is further away. It would actually have to be an infinite sheet in order to do the canceling. So, I don't know, as I say, to me it's surprising. Magnetic field is exactly zero outside the solenoid, and inside it's given by this relationship, which is pretty similar to what you had in 200. Lots of times we needed to use the fact that the integral of an odd function over a symmetrical interval was equal to zero in order to get these simple results. And this equation, which we used for electric fields, cropped up a couple of times, and this equation cropped up a couple of times, which was one of these odd integrals that just by changing the size of one of the parameters, we go from something to nothing. Oh, no, you can easily have one without the other.
Okay.
Yes. So I guess your question is, what's going to make this current flow without an electric field pushing it? Well, a superconductor, once you get a current going, it goes forever. So superconducting solenoids like this, which we have examples of downstairs, once you get the current going, 100 amp current going, you can turn off your power supply. It'll continue basically forever. Yeah, well, not all the way in the basement. It's not that old stuff. And a 100 amp power supply to power it up. Take some liquid helium to make it go. It's a 10 Tesla magnet.
So, like the right hand rule, the magnetic field goes around the wire. So, what if we only have a segment of the wire? What happens above the wire? Because you can't do the right hand rule anymore. Does it get wider, or does it kind of point?
So the question he's talking about proposes, it's impossible, but proposes that we have a wire segment where there is current comes from no place and it goes up this wire and it disappears from no place. And it's not as useless as your last suggests, because kind of the idea is you could put together a lot of these sort of solutions to make something that could physically exist. Right, so all you have to do is to take your solution and now you can figure out what the magnetic field is for a triangle of wires. So your question is, so this is really a question in mathematics, not physics, right? So the idea is that we've got that formula and we're going to integrate it up and find out what the magnetic field is. And what you find is that in fact the magnetic field is still going around at some distance from the wire.
Not quite as powerful,
and if you're right on the wire, it's going to zero. So if we're right on the wire here, it's going to go to infinity because we're infinitesimally close to a current. If you look at the mathematics, it's a little bit tricky to see, but if you go to z equals zero above the wire, it doesn't go to infinity. It just goes to, in fact, zero.
Kind of be like a ring, except it's...
For sure, yep. If we actually put together those three solutions to get us what the magnetic field is for this triangle, it would look a lot like what it does with the ring. That is to say, the magnetic field would be kind of going like that. It would be going into this area and sweeping around.
Okay.
And actually, the reason I assigned this problem is last year I assigned a problem where we had a square, and it's kind of a nice problem. You can find out what the magnetic field is lots of places, but it's kind of nicer in theory than in practice. The algebra becomes pretty ugly pretty fast for it. More questions? So I think I even referenced that problem in the assignments.txt. Okay, so today is the day you've been waiting for, where we get to prove some stuff about magnetic fields as opposed to kind of speculating. And you also see you should have a handout like this that's got a lot of algebra on it, where we're going to be applying this kind of ugly stuff. So you might notice on the top of this it says the vector potential is not your friend. Right? So these equations are going to be ugly, which is kind of why I Xeroxed off this stuff so you didn't have to follow it in detail. But while it's not your friend in detail for calculations, it is our friend for proving a lot of stuff. So what we're looking for is something that's the equivalent of voltage, right? So voltage was really handy, right? Because we could calculate a scalar quantity and we could get the electric field from it kind of for free. And so it'd be really nice to have a potential that goes along with the magnetic field. And there is such a beast, but unfortunately it lacks the advantage of voltage. That is to say, the so-called vector potential is going to be a vector, and therefore it's not going to be any easier to calculate than the magnetic field is. And then you have to take the curl of it, which is never any fun. So as I say, practically it's pretty much a bust. I can't think of many good uses for it, but you really need it to prove stuff. So what we want to show is that we can always calculate any magnetic field as the curl of something. And what we know is that we can calculate the magnetic field the way Biot-Savart told us to do it. We just integrate up, and we'll deal with J's here. So we want J is the source, so we're going to have an R prime, and I'll have a DV prime here at the end. We want to cross that into the distance from that source divided by R minus R prime cubed. And what the trick we've kind of used lots of times is that this quantity, that's not a very different color, that this quantity, that is just like an electric field. And just like an electric field, we could calculate this thing as being minus the gradient of 1 over the magnitude of R minus R prime. And I do want to stress that I am taking the derivatives not with respect to the prime coordinates, but with respect to the R coordinates here. Very soon we're going to have delta primes, and heaven forbid that I forget to put an extra prime on. Right? It's all the difference in the world. So you might remember that obviously for this quantity, the difference is just this minus sign. So I could get exactly this quantity by taking minus or plus the gradient with respect to the prime coordinates. But that's not the plan. Okay, so if we look at our book, page 20, which I don't really expect you to do, but I'll write it down here for the future. There's a bunch of properties of vectors, and the one we particularly need is what is the curl of a scalar function times a vector. How do we go about calculating that? And the answer is it kind of distributes. That is to say, we get the gradient of phi crossed into f, and we get phi times the curl of f. Okay, so we have something like that right here, right? We have the gradient of something crossed into a vector. And actually, we can use this minus sign to get it in exactly this order. You remember that to switch things around in a cross product, it's just a minus sign difference. So if I do all of that, I can replace what's the integrand by having the curl of J, that's our vector F, times this function phi, which is the magnitude of r minus r prime. And then I want to subtract off phi, and I'm going to write it just as phi for to save a little bit of space, times the curl of J of r prime. And this should all be integrated dv if I had space. Now here's the main reason I chose to write this as, I don't know if it's the main reason, here's a reason that I chose to write this as the gradient with respect to the r coordinates as opposed to the r prime coordinates, and that is that this is zero, right? Because J depends on r prime, not r. And this is the derivative with respect to the parameter r as opposed to what we're integrating, so this can come outside of the integral. So what we've got then is mu naught over 4 pi, the curl of the integral of J r prime divided by the magnitude of r minus r prime dv prime. So along with this 4 pi, I can call this quantity A, and I've proved what I wanted to prove. Notice that this is a whole lot like what we had for the voltage, right? So the voltage was 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the charge density, r minus r prime. So all we have now is a current density as opposed to a charge density. Very, very similar sort of formula. Yes? So this all equals B. So I've shown that we can calculate B by taking the curl of something, and the something is this integral, which we're going to call A.
That whole integral is A.
Yes. So A now is the vector that is mu naught divided by 4 pi. Add up J vector at all of those source points and divide by r minus r prime, and you get dv prime. In the book? I don't know. So we have done something that's strange, which is one of the reasons I don't know, is in the book they talk about forces first and then they start talking about fields. And the force stuff really looks pretty ugly. So if you looked at that assignment, that text, I say that chapter 8 looks nasty because it's starting out with all that force stuff. So we've skipped over that force stuff. We're going to come back to it in a couple of lectures. We've skipped over it and done what I think looks easier, right? This all stuff, I hope, doesn't look that, all that. I mean, the cross products make it twice as nasty as electric fields, but it has some sort of similarity. The force stuff really looks radically different and involves a whole lot more algebra than the equivalent thing that an electric field did. And I mean, the book is in some sense doing it right, because magnetic fields are defined by their forces, and I just kind of assumed that you all knew what a magnetic field was from 200, so we could go and calculate it without really carefully defining it. But we'll come back to that earlier stuff on forces. Maybe not next time, maybe the time after that. So what this means is, boom, we popped into the middle of chapter 8. More questions? So there was a special property that it never seems to play a very important role about potential energies, right? And that is that you could always add a constant to that potential energy and you would get exactly the same force or electric field or whatever. Right? A pretty forgettable factoid. But there's a whole lot more freedom for this A. I could add to my A the gradient of any function you name, because the curl of the gradient is guaranteed to be zero. It's one of those properties that we showed early on. So there's a whole lot more freedom in our choice of A, right? We don't have to just choose this A. We can choose any old thing that whose curl is B, but that quantity is going to be way more undefined than the voltages, which was only undefined up to a constant. So this freedom turns out to be extremely important and extremely troublesome, and it's called gauge freedom. And what we're talking about when we're changing A by something like this is a gauge transformation. And I would be hard put to think of anything more important in the last 30 years in physics besides these sorts of gauge transformations. And maybe the short way I can convince you of this is that all known forces, the force that holds quarks together, the force that causes weak decay, all known forces, including gravity, are gauge forces. And that realization is the basis of our understanding about how particle physics works. Okay, so right now it seems like more or less a triviality, and it'll be a triviality as far as this course is concerned, but you have been told that gauge stuff is important, and you should be listening carefully when that occurs. Okay, so we've got our A. That's just a start. We want to show a couple of properties of this A, and one of them is reminiscent of Poisson's equation. So you might remember that Poisson's equation said that if we took the Laplacian of phi, what we got is minus the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And that came about because of our friend the delta function, where we show that the Laplacian of 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime was minus 4 pi delta. You remember these delta functions are the things that are zero every place except where their argument is zero, of r minus r prime. Okay, so that's how we prove that. We simply take the Laplacian of this, we get the Laplacian of, the only place there's an r is right here, so we get the Laplacian of this. We get a delta function, and when we integrate a delta function, we just get the value of the function evaluated where it's singular. And I don't know if I need to write anything down. It's exactly the same thing for A, right? So if I were to take the Laplacian of, say, A sub x, what I'm going to get is mu naught over 4 pi, the integral of, again, j doesn't depend on r, it depends on r prime, so that I would have, so this would be j sub x, I guess, so this would be the Laplacian of 1 over the magnitude of r minus r prime, dv prime. This thing here is going to give me minus 4 pi times the delta function, and when I integrate up that delta function, all I do is get the integrand, which is j, evaluated where r equals r prime. So what we've got then is minus mu naught j x for the Laplacian of ax. And, you know, we can easily generalize that to the Laplacian of the a vector is minus mu naught the j vector. I really need to comment that what I did really wants to be in rectangular coordinates. So if you want to figure out what the Laplacian is, what the vector Laplacian is in spherical coordinates, you have to do a whole lot of work. If you look at that little book I handed out, it does give you the formula for what the Laplacian is of a of something in spherical coordinates, but it's not in the back of our book, for example, and it is pretty complicated. And basically how you would get it is by backcab. What is backcab? Yeah. Backcab? Remember that from
it's just at the start of chapter 3.
For spherical coordinates, does it really?
At least spherical, doesn't
it? Oh, I think you're misunderstanding. It gives you the Laplacian of a scalar.
Fair enough.
But there's a different formula for the Laplacian of a vector that is way more complicated. So only in rectangular coordinates can I say that the Laplacian is just the normal derivative with respect to x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And since the unit vectors don't depend on x, y, or z, they kind of come out of the equation. But if I want to take the Laplacian of something in a Laplacian of some vector that is given in components in the r direction, theta direction, and phi direction, then it's a mess. So take a look at your little book. It has the formula in there, which we'll never use, but it is worth commenting about. So if I think about this in terms of these guys being gradients, what I'm going to get is the Laplacian of C minus the divergence of C in the gradient of the divergence of C. I guess that's what I wanted. Yes. So the Laplacian of some vector is the curl of the curl of that vector plus the gradient of the divergence of that vector.
What is that second line?
Say again?
The second line from the bottom.
This one?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that this formula, this back cab formula, was something that you showed for normal vectors. And it's not really correct to just replace a vector by an operator. But that's what I did. I know when I can get away with it. And this is a case where you can get away with it. And you do get the right answer from doing this. But be wary of doing it in other circumstances. The little gradient symbol.
Up in the middle, under the minus.
Oh, so that one should be there too. Right? I dropped it, right? So here it's correctly written. So this came over to this side and became a plus, right? Wait. Okay, I did do it wrong. But I don't. Okay, so let me write it right once. But I don't see any real purpose in this. So I missed my sign here. So what we've got is, well, I'm not going to bother to write it. It's just we're not going to actually use it. But my point is that. Vector Laplacians really are more complicated than scalar Laplacians, so you want to be a little bit careful about using them. Okay, so one property we wanted to prove was this guy. And the other property we wanted to prove was that the divergence of A is equal to zero. So this doesn't have to be the case, but it's true for our particular formula for A, namely that A is mu naught over 4 pi integrate up j of r prime divided by r minus r prime dv prime. There are lots of other a's that work, but this a is going to have the additional property that the divergence of a is zero. And it's one of those kind of standard things where the plan is going to be to bring that gradient inside the integral and then use some of our vector properties to distribute that gradient around. And then we're going to do something a little bit tricky. Then we're going to change that gradient into a gradient prime and undo what we did. Okay, so sounds like we're not going to win anything by this, but let's see. I claim we will. But it's sure going to look a lot like I do something and undo it and get a different answer. So watch carefully for the magic. Okay, so we got the divergence of A, and the only place there is a R is here, so I can bring that gradient inside. So I have the divergence of J of R prime divided by R minus R prime dV prime. And now I can use the formula that the divergence of a, I think I wrote it before, I think I wrote it in terms of phi and f, the divergence, the divergence of a scalar function times a vector function is equal to the gradient of phi times dotted into f plus phi times the divergence of f. Okay, so this is gradient and there's the dot product. And this is just chain rule. There's nothing particularly tricky about that. Okay, so what I'm going to have is something that looks a whole lot like this, except J doesn't depend on R prime. So that term is going to be absent. So what I'm going to have here is just mu naught over 4 pi. Add up the gradient of 1 over the magnitude of R minus R prime, dotted into J of R prime dV prime. Okay, so now I do the sleight of hand, and I remind you that this is the same thing as minus the derivative with respect to the prime coordinates of R minus R prime. So what I've got here then is, I'll pull the minus sign out, minus mu naught over 4 pi, the integral of the gradient prime of R minus R prime dotted into J of R prime dV prime. So what I've got is a term that's like this. So I can just use that equation to switch it around. So evidently, that red block is the same thing as the divergence with respect to the prime coordinates of 1 over R minus R prime times J of R prime, but I have to subtract off this other term, minus 1 over R minus R prime times the divergence with respect to the prime coordinates of J. And that's zero, right? For steady flow, the divergence of J is zero. And Gauss says that if I have the volume integral of the divergence, I can convert that into a surface integral. So what I've got is minus mu naught over 4 pi, the surface integral of 1 over R minus R prime, J of R prime, dotted into the normal of that area, dA prime. So who can see that that's zero? I can. So let's think about how it has to work. So here was the volume that had this current that was flowing in it that we were integrating up here. That current can't be leaving, right? Or else we would have to have a larger volume. It has to be tangent to the surface if it's confined to that volume. And therefore, when I dot that J with the normal, I have to get zero. So up here we were integrating way back when we were finding A, before we took the divergence of it, we were integrating up this quantity where the current was. And so we can think about that current flowing around in some volume. And now we've converted that into a surface integral. But it's a surface integral of J dotted into the normal. And if that current is confined to that volume, it's not going through that volume. It has to be tangent to that volume. If you don't like that argument, just use a larger volume, right? Integrate over this volume instead, where J is clearly zero, right? Expand, it doesn't matter here. I can expand my volume without hurting things. I'm just adding up lots of zeros where J is zero. And here on this boundary, J is certainly zero. So either way you figure it, you can either have a tight boundary or a loose boundary. That quantity is zero, and therefore the divergence of A is zero. Okay, so the two properties we've shown is the divergence of this particular A is zero, and we've shown that the vector Laplacian of A was minus mu naught times the current. Okay, so these are exactly the two properties I'm going to need in order to take a look at what the curl of B is. I see that I am going to need my formula. So the curl of B is the same thing as the curl of B. And that's the same thing as the gradient of the divergence of A minus the Laplacian of A. And you'll either find that formula in on page 20 of your textbook, or it really is just backcabbing this quantity here. So we've shown that the divergence of A is 0. And we know that the vector Laplacian of A is minus mu naught j. So what we've got is that the curl of j, the curl of B is just j. So what? What is that? What all does that buy us? Well, let me write one other thing first, I guess. So you remember I said a moment ago that you are guaranteed that the curl of the gradient of some function is equal to 0. That is just, if you just write out the determinant form of this, you can see that you have canceling derivatives. In an exactly analogous way, if you take the divergence of the curl of something, it's also guaranteed to be 0. And it's exactly the same story. You're taking mixed, well, let's prove this one because it isn't going to take any time. Can I convince you that this is exactly the same thing as derivative with respect to x, derivative with respect to y, derivative with respect to z, of derivative with respect to x, derivative with respect to y, derivative with respect to z, of fx, fy, fz. So you're probably used to seeing ijk up here if this is the curl, but if I'm taking the divergence of it, then I'm going to take the x derivative of whatever the x component is, I'm going to take the y derivative, whatever the y derivative is. Did I sell that? Not so much. Somewhat. And this, I hope you can see, is 0, right? We're always going to get mixed partials. Okay, so now that I've got everything, let's do a brief review. So for electric fields, we had that the divergence of the electric field was equal to the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And we had that the curl of E was equal to 0. I remind you that this was required in order to write E as minus the gradient of something. I don't know if you proved that last semester in vector calculus or not, but curl of E being 0, you probably should have proved it in mechanics by proving what a conservative force was. I don't know. And now we've shown that the divergence of B is equal to 0, and the curl of B is equal to mu naught J. And I got to say a word about this word proof that I guess I just used. How we did this is we started with Coulomb, and we started with Biot-Savart, and we derived these sort of relationships. In the end, it's going to be bait and switch. I'm going to tell you that these guys are wrong and that these guys are right. Okay, so mathematicians wouldn't approve of this process. But the idea is that I'm trying to get you confidence in these equations are nothing more than stuff that you knew really commonly from 200. But these guys are not exactly correct. When we have, they're perfectly good in static situations. If nothing is changing, they do give the right answer. But if we have changing currents, then it turns out that they do not give the right answer. But these guys, as we suitably modify them, will give us the right answer. Okay, so these are a start on what are usually called Maxwell's equations. And they're called Maxwell's equations because Maxwell didn't write them down. Some of these are going to change in the future. So this guy here is a forever equation. We're never going to change that guy. This guy here is a forever equation. We're not going to change that guy. In the next chapter, we're going to talk about induction. So induction are cases where you can drive a current by having a changing magnetic field. You can drive a current in a circle, and that requires that the curl of E not be zero. So induction is going to kill this guy. We're going to have another term for that guy. And then there's kind of the equivalent of induction for magnetic fields, that changing electric fields can make magnetic fields. And that was really Maxwell's chief Maxwell had lots of important contributions, but that's certainly one of the important realizations that Maxwell made, was that if changing magnetic fields make electric fields, then there has to be a term here where changing electric fields make magnetic fields. Okay, so that's all good stuff. That's more or less forever. We derive it from stuff that isn't true, but we trust it implicitly with our lives from here on out. Okay, so that ends the proof portion. We've got big. I have one other comment, I guess, to make. That is that in 200, you called things Maxwell's equations that were different from this. Right? So you've said, for example, that Maxwell's equation was that if we integrated up E dot n dA, we got the enclosed charge divided by epsilon naught. And you know that that's just a consequence of this equation where we use the integral theorem that we associate with Gauss. So in 200, you said that if you had a loop, a line loop that goes around and comes back, and you integrate B dot dl around that loop, what you got was the enclosed current times mu naught. And that turns out to be an immediate consequence of that curl equation. So let's show that. Called Ampere's laws in integral form. So it's kind of a question of how to sketch this. So we have Gaussian surfaces, which are imaginary closed surfaces. So now we're going to have Amperean loops. So here is an imaginary loop in space. And there might be some currents that are flowing through that loop. Might not be two. Maybe some of them are going up. Maybe some of them are going down. Who knows? Now, what I'm going to be particularly interested in here in the start is the surface area of this loop. Okay. So if I integrate the surface area of that loop, and I take the J and I dot it with N and I multiply it by dA, well, the current density is just the current per area. So if I multiply that by area and add it up, I'm going to get the total current that's going through this purple area. But this equation promises us that J is the same thing as 1 over mu naught times the curl of B. So we have this surface integral of the curl of B. And Ampere promises us that we can convert integrals like this to a loop integral around the boundary. That's one of those three integral theorems we had in chapter 1. Okay, put the mu naught on the other side, and we've got this guy. Okay, so this integral version of Ampere's law provides a shortcut for finding magnetic fields, much the way that Gauss's law provides a shortcut for finding electric fields when we have lots of symmetry. And so if you've looked at the homework for next time, I have you taking these examples that we've proved, which had lots of symmetry, and showing how you could have gotten those same answers just using Ampere's law. Okay, so now you can flip over to that handout I gave you that starts out, "The vector potential is not your friend." Because we're going to want to calculate it in some real simple examples, just because we like to calculate things. So the starting point is going to be to calculate the vector potential for a current loop. So I'm going to have, sitting in the xy plane, I'm going to have a loop. Maybe I'll have a purple loop, a fruit loop. And we're interested in calculating the vector potential. We'd like to, so we can calculate it every place if we know what complete elliptic integrals are, but you'll see we'll soon make some approximations that make it more solvable. So what we've got is the formula for A. It's mu naught over 4 pi, add up the current density at the source location and divide it by the distance that we are from that location, dV prime. So the first thing we've got is a substitution, right? So this was done in terms of JdVs, and we know that they're the same things as KdAs, and that they are the same thing as an IdL. Right? It's all current that's flowing. It can be flowing over a surface or in a wire. And what I said is that this current was flowing in a wire. So the other thing we need to talk about is, what are all of these quantities? So we've got symmetry, so we might as well, without loss of generality, consider our observation point to be in the xz plane, right? Because any other plane is going to be the same thing, just rotated around. R prime has to point at all of these points in the circle, so it has to be a, did I use phi? I guess I used phi. So it's going to be a R cosine phi, R sine phi, and it's all in the z equals 0 plane. This little dl, it's in the direction that we would call the phi direction. And we actually worked that out last time. That unit vector is going to be minus sine phi, cosine phi, and then 0 in the z direction. Okay, so what we've got then is that A, well, so let me write R minus R prime and then find its magnitude. So R minus R prime is going to be X minus RC minus RS and Z. And then the magnitude of that vector. So we're going to get a R squared cosine squared theta, an R squared sine squared theta, a Z squared, and an X squared, all of those things. And we're going to get a cross term from this first term that's going to be minus 2xrc. Okay, so with that, we can write down what A is. A is mu naught over 4 pi. Integrate all the way around, say from minus pi to pi. We have this vector The I is a constant. We have this vector that we're supposed to integrate, which is minus sine phi cosine phi 0. And then we have, I'm just going to write r minus r prime, exactly that quantity there. And the length of this segment is going to be r d theta. R d phi, I guess we're calling it. Okay, so kind of in the upper right-hand corner, you should see all of that sitting there. Okay, so can everyone see that the x component of this integral is 0? Because sine is an odd function. The y component is not going to be 0. And of course, what that means is that the vector, so here we are on the xz plane. We know that then the a vector is going to be in the y direction, kind of like that. So if we're in a different plane, that's going to rotate with it. So really, this thing that's in the y direction is in the phi direction if we're in a more general coordinate system. So what we've got then is a, and the other thing we've got is that x squared plus z squared, that is the distance that we are from the origin. Again, if we rotate it around to a different plane, that's the more general possibility. So what we've got then is I mu naught r divided by 4 pi, add up from minus pi to pi, cosine of phi divided by the square root of x squared plus z squared is just r squared. This is the spherical r now. And this is the radius of the hoop. And then we've got minus 2. And now we've got the cylindrical r. I'm going to write it just as x for the time being. We'll come back to it in a second. R times cosine of phi. And all this is integrated d phi. So what is x in the more general case? Well, so x is this distance that we are from the z-axis. And in spherical coordinates, we call this angle theta. So x is equal to r sine theta. Right? So phi is the angle around that we're integrating on. Theta is the spherical coordinate that's describing where we are. Okay, so I don't know, about 4 lines down, you should see that on that sheet of paper, right? And I comment that Mathematica really can integrate that out in terms of the elliptic functions that are called k and e, but it actually takes Mathematica about 5 minutes to do it. And in the end, my guess is that neither of us have a good picture for what the k and e functions look like. So the plan is to make some approximations. We're probably mostly interested in the magnetic field a little bit away from this loop. Well, actually, we're calculating the A field here. But yeah, well, one way or the other, the only easy thing we can calculate is the A and the B fields if we're not right up close and personal to that loop. So the plan is to pull out of this radical this quantity, r squared plus r squared. So if we do that, what we've got left there, so forgetting about the radical for the time being, what we have then is r squared plus r squared being pulled out, and we've got 1 minus 2 r sine theta divided by r squared plus r squared, all of that times cosine phi. And our plan is to approximate that. Right, so this is all actually, so I now bring back the square root. These are actually all to the 1/2. Oops. Okay, so it's they're to the 1/2 in the denominator. So what we have then is 1 minus x to the minus 1/2. And you remember that we did the problem of 1 minus x to the alpha. And approximately speaking, this is going to be 1 plus 1/2 x. And if we want the general term, this is 1 over n factorial 1/2 sub n x to the n. But we're only going to quit as soon as we can. Okay, so what we've got is what you should have written down one line down, but let's write it up here. So by symmetry, remember we only started with the y component, but we argued that it really was more generally the phi component of A. And we had all of this stuff, the current, mu naught, the radius of the loop, divided by 4 pi, those all went along with for the ride. And r squared plus r squared, those are constants as far as the integration goes, so those can also be pulled out. And what we have left then is the integral from minus pi to pi of 1 plus 1/2, stuff that I don't have room to write, d phi. So let's write it down here. So what we've got then is the 1/2 is going to kill that 1/2. So we're going to have r sine theta divided by r squared plus r squared all times cosine phi. And there also wanted to be a cosine phi in here. Luckily, it's written correctly on your sheet of paper. Okay, so far so good. Who can see that this term gives zero? I should ask that question the other way around. So that term is the integral of cosine theta integrated over a full cycle, right? And there's as much positive area as there is negative area for cosine theta. So it's not an even-odd argument. Cosine is even, but the area under cosine for a full cycle is zero. True? Maybe. So the other term is going to have a cosine times cosine, a cosine squared. What is the integral of cosine squared over a full cycle? Well, I hope you know that the average value of cosine is 1/2. So we have 1/2 times the full range of integration. Okay, so what do we got after we do all of this magic? So we've got these constants that haven't been doing a whole lot. And we've got these things here, which are also constant as far as the integral is concerned. So if we put those things together, we're going to have r squared plus r squared to the 3/2. And we're going to have an r and an r and a sine theta. And then we have the integral of cosine squared, which is going to produce a pi. Okay. So now kind of some simplification that is really renaming and maybe using a little bit of memory from 200. We talked about electric dipole moments, P, and those things were pretty clear. They were charge that was separated by some distance. And this thing was just the charge separation times the distance. For magnetic fields, we don't have point charges, right? There isn't the divergence of B is equal to zero as opposed to being equal to rho over epsilon naught. So So the upshot of that is that magnetic field lines don't start on north poles and end on south poles, because north and south poles don't exist. Magnetic field lines must be closed loops. So we don't have magnetic monopoles, at least not yet. So we can't define our magnetic dipole moment that way. Fundamentally, what we have are current loops. And what you did in 200 is you defined a magnetic dipole moment, which had a direction that was given by the right-hand rule. So the, curl your fingers in the way the current is going, and that's going to give you a direction. And the magnitude of this magnetic dipole moment, which I think we're going to denote by lowercase m, it's often denoted by the Greek letter mu, is the area times the current. Okay, so this is a magnetic dipole moment. And we're about to show that it produces the same shape magnetic field as the electric field that was produced by a dipole like this. Okay, so with that definition, this magnetic dipole moment is area times current. By taking this term and this term and this term and that term, I've got pi r squared times I, I've got the magnetic dipole moment then. So that's really just a definition of what I mean by m under this particular circumstance, pi r squared times I. So what I've got is mu naught times m divided by 4 pi. And I guess what's left over then is r sine theta divided by r squared plus r squared to the 3/2. Okay, and if we're at great distances, then r is going to be much bigger than capital R. So this thing is going to be about equal to r cubed in the denominator. So what we've got then is, I'll rewrite it all, mu naught m divided by 4 pi. This r cubed is going to cancel one of those r's, so we're going to have sine theta divided by r squared. The other limit is also of interest, of course. If we're close to the origin, then we can neglect that term, and then what we're going to get is mu naught m divided by 4 pi r sine theta divided by capital R cubed. Okay. Now, it's helpful to write this in a vector notation, because then we can kind of switch things around. So this magnetic field, or this A vector, was all in the phi direction. So I would like to be able to generate a vector that's in the phi direction. And if you think about it, I can do that by crossing the M vector, which is in the K direction, with the R vector, which is going to be radially outward. So if you think about this on the some spherical surface, if I take the cross product of K and R hat, I'm going to be producing a vector that is going around this sphere. It's in the phi hat direction. Now it's going to have magnitude that's given by the sine, like any cross product, going to have a magnitude that's given by the sine of the angle between these guys. And that's exactly what we want. So I claim I can write my A vector, now not just the phi component, as mu naught over 4 pi, the magnetic dipole moment crossed into the R vector divided by R cubed. Okay, where in general R is the vector that is pointing from the magnetic dipole to wherever we're trying to observe the A field that's produced. Okay. So if we want to know what the B, I claimed that from this A field, we were going to calculate the B field, and it was going to be exactly the same form as the B field that we got from the electric dipole. And I don't know, maybe I will just point at what's below on your handout. If you look up for what the curl is in spherical coordinates, I've written it down for you. And if we take that process through, three lines from the bottom, we've got that the magnetic field is mu naught divided by 4 pi r cubed, 3 r hat dotted into m minus m. I don't know if you remember, but that's exactly the formula that we had for electric fields, except we had p's instead of m's, and instead of having a mu naught, we had an epsilon naught in the denominator. So the shape of the magnetic field at great distances from this loop is exactly the same shape as the electric field from an electric dipole. And there's a little bit of trickery that goes on into getting it that's over there to the side, that we can write the k-hat vector as cosine in the r-hat direction minus sine theta in the phi direction. And if you... 2 minutes, I guess I've got. Maybe that's the piece that we can talk about. So any vector can be written as a linear combination of the basis vectors, right? That's the basis of Fourier's trick, right? So I can have A times R hat plus B times theta hat has to be the case. And if I want to figure out what B is, all I have to do is to dot the thing that we're trying to expand with the corresponding unit vector. So this has to be k hat dot theta hat. And this quantity here has to be k hat dot r hat. And you can see from this diagram that k hat dot r hat is going to give me the cosine of the angle between them, which is what we call theta. Theta hat is in this perpendicular direction like that. And so the angle between these, it's going to be negative, therefore. And the angle between them, if we kind of add these up, this is going to be an angle that is theta minus 90 degrees. And the cosine of theta minus 90 degrees is sine. So we're going to get out of this is minus sine theta. And kind of physically, if you think about it, k hat is going up, r hat is going out, and theta hat is going that way. So we need a negative bit of that theta hat in order to give us that k hat. And for example, when theta equals 90 degrees, when we're on the equator, then k hat is going to be exactly equal to minus theta hat. So cosine of 90 degrees is 0, so there's no r hat. And sine of 90 degrees is 1, so we get exactly minus theta hat. So that little note off to the side is exactly correct. Okay, so I'm not sure I've convinced you yet that this isn't a friendly way of doing it, but we've got more ugliness ahead. So I think I'll have to change the assignment a little.